Welcome now to the Access Utah Holiday Special. We'll feature Mike Christiansen on the guitar playing music for the holidays, and we have playwright Tim Slover. Also in studios with us, the author of Christmas Chronicles, among other works. He's presenting humorous and poignant readings for the season. So welcome in to this annual treat, at least a treat for me, and I hope for you as well, the Access Utah Holiday Special. So let me start with you, Tim. Tim Slover, playwright, University of Utah. Right. Author of the Christmas Chronicles. For our audience, we play this every year, and
thank you.
This year is no different. And that's your creation, right? Christmas Chronicles.
It is. They started out as stories I told our two boys when they were little, and now they're big. They're way really, really big, much bigger than me.
And this is the true story of the. It's kind of the origin story for Santa.
It is. You may know that there are other origin stories for Santa, but this is the straight dope, actually.
Right, right. Yeah, wonderful. You've written plays, right?
And you've plays.
Written a play about Handel and other plays.
Yeah.
As well. You do study abroad as well with students. So not a bad life.
You've been looking in my emails.
I have been looking at your emails, yes. Wonderful. I also happen to know this is a very special time of year for you and your family.
Yeah, we love Christmas. We always have. I was talking to Mike this year. We're doing something a little different. We're going to Mexico for Christmas, thanks to my excellent brother-in-law and his timeshare.
That's great. That's wonderful. That'd be a little different. Yeah, yeah. Well, we always love you having you come up and appreciate you doing that.
It's an entire treat for me. I just love this.
Well, Mike Christiansen is with us. He'll be providing the music. Mike, same to you. It's just love this. Have you come in? This starts the whole Christmas season for me.
Thank you. I love doing it. This is one of the best gigs of the year, and one of the ones that I don't have to worry about what I look like.
Yeah, right. But for our radio audience, he looks great. Tim does as well. So. Very briefly Mike, I know you and your family celebrate some of your Scandinavian traditions.
We do. We're Danish, and we have a lot of traditions. There's a traditional meal that we have. We have everyone has an ornament at the dinner that they open that is representative of something that happened to them during that year. Full of traditions throughout. We get the tree out and we all dance around the tree and open the gifts from the family that night, and then Santa comes the next morning, and it's a great time.
Yeah, it's great to embrace those traditions. Yeah. And you know, create some new ones, you know, like Tim has, that the true story of Santa. So Mike, tell us what you're gonna play first.
I'll play a song that had 50 million copies sold by Bing Crosby. This is the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Strangely enough, the original was lost, and then it was re-recorded. There's a recording that came out in 1942, and it kind of got worn out. And then it was redone in 1947, and then it was remixed again in 1999. But... And Bing Crosby didn't want to do it in his USO tours, but he went out and did the tours and didn't include that song. And there was a great rebellion among the military guys that they wanted him to do this song. They wanted to hear White Christmas. And so he put it in, and it was written by Irving Berlin. It was written for the film in 1942 for Holiday Inn. Rumor or the story goes that Irving wrote it in a hotel in Beverly Hills, and in fact, in the verse to the song, before the song actually kicks in, it's the words are, "The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day." So it's oddly enough, it was written where it was very warm. And oddly enough, too, that Irving Berlin didn't celebrate Christmas. He was Jewish, but wrote this song, which was great. When he wrote it, he gave it to his secretary and said, "Take this over and present this, get this ready to distribute, and tell my publicist that I've written the best Christmas song ever. And then he said, no, tell him I've written the best song ever. So anyway, this is White Christmas. I'm going to play kind of a rubato version first, and then I think I'll play we'll do it as a bossa nova. And Tim mentioned that he's going to Mexico, and the style that I'll play White Christmas in, this bossa nova, is kind of Brazilian, where all they can do, where Tim is going, is dream about a White Christmas. Here.
Only here on Access Utah, and of course at Mike's concerts. That's a beautiful Brazilian bossa nova rendition of White Christmas. That's beautiful, Mike.
Thank you.
I think I always mention this because it struck me so much, Mike. You, at a certain point, you went to Brazil, as you said, to lose your accent.
Right. Yeah, I got down there and was working with Antonio Adolfo, who's a very well-known composer and pianist down there, and I wanted to go down and study with him, and when I walked in to do some work with him, he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I want to lose my accent. I said, I sound like a lot of other American guitar players when I play bossa nova and samba, and I want to lose my accent. And he said, okay, well, we'll have you take percussion lessons. So so I studied with Ari Diaz, a percussionist, and worked on my percussion stuff, and then applied that to the guitar, which makes a lot of sense because you try to imitate it with your right hand on guitar what the percussionists do. And so that it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. When I left, Antonio said, Mike, you sound like a carioca, which means a local. And I knew he was lying, but it made me feel good anyway.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Let's turn to Tim Slover. What's the first piece you're going to do for us?
The 1950s and the 1960s were kind of a golden era for women's writing, fiction, and particularly short stories that would get published in what were the so-called women's magazines and church magazines. But they're wonderful, and it's a huge treasure trove. So I've selected one by a woman named Dina Donahue. It was published first in the Baptist Herald on December 15, 1968. This is called Trouble at the Inn. For years now, whenever Christmas pageants are talked about in a certain little town in the Midwest, someone is sure to mention the name of Wallace Perling. Wally's performance in one annual production of the Nativity play has slipped into the realm of legend. But the old-timers who were in the audience that night never tire of recalling exactly what happened. Wally was 9 years that year, 9 years old, and in the second grade, though he should have been in the fourth. Most people in town knew that he had difficulty in keeping up. He was big and clumsy, slow in movement and mind. Still, Wally was well-liked by the other children in his class, all of whom were smaller than he, though the boys had trouble hiding their irritation if the uncoordinated Wally asked to play ball with them. Most often, they'd find a way to keep him off the field, but Wally would hang around anyway, not sulking, just hoping. He was always a helpful boy, a willing and smiling one, and the natural protector, paradoxically, of the underdog. Sometimes, if the older boys chased the younger ones away, it would always be Wally who'd say, "Can't they stay? They're no bother." Wally fancied the idea of being a shepherd with a flute in the Christmas pageant that year, but the play's director, Miss Lombard, assigned him to a more important role. After all, she reasoned, the innkeeper did not have too many lines, and Wally's size would make his refusal of lodging to Joseph more forceful. And so it happened that the usual large partisan audience gathered for the town's Yuletide extravaganza of the staffs and creches of beards, crowns, halos, and a whole stage full of squeaky voices. No one on stage or off was more caught up in the magic of the night than Wallace Perling. They said later that he stood in the wings and watched the performance with such fascination that from time to time Miss Lombard had to make sure he didn't wander on stage before his cue. Then the time came when Joseph appeared, slowly, tenderly, guiding Mary to the door of the inn. Joseph knocked hard on the wooden door set into the painted backdrop. Wally, the innkeeper, was there, waiting. "What do you want?" Wally said, swinging the door open with a brusque gesture. "We seek lodging." "Seek it elsewhere." Wally looked straight ahead, but spoke vigorously. "The inn is filled." "Sir, we have asked everywhere in vain. We have traveled far and are very weary." "There is no room in this inn for you." Wally looked properly stern. "Please, good innkeeper, this is my wife, Mary. She is heavy with child and needs a place to rest. Surely you must have some small corner for her. She is so tired." Now, for the first time, the innkeeper relaxed his stiff stance and looked down at Mary. With that, there was a long pause, long enough to make the audience a bit tense with embarrassment.
"No, be gone," the prompter whispered from the wings.
"No," Wally repeated automatically. "Be gone." Joseph sadly placed his arm around Mary, and Mary laid her head upon his shoulder, and the two of them started to move away. The innkeeper did not return inside his inn, however. Wally stood there in the doorway, watching the forlorn couple. His mouth was open, his brow creased with concern, his eyes filling unmistakably with tears.
"Don't go, Joseph," Wally called out. "Bring Mary back."
And Wallace Perling's face grew into a bright smile.
"You can have my room."
Some people in town thought that the pageant had been ruined. Yet there were others, many others, who considered it the most Christmas of all Christmas pageants they had ever seen.
So tell us the author and title again.
It's called Trouble at the Inn by, I think it's Dinah, not Dina, mm-hmm. Dinah Donahue.
Oh, wonderful. Where do you encounter these? How do you choose these?
I go into search mode starting January 1 for this very program.
Oh, well, thank you.
I just start doing the research and come across 100 or so and then just winnow it down to the perfect ones.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that. Thank you. Very good. Tim Slover with some great readings for the season. And we have with us on this Access Utah Holiday Special, Mike Christiansen on the guitar, playing music for the holidays. Mike, what's up next?
I'll play a tune that reminded me, the story behind this tune reminds me of a recording session that I had with Eric Nelson with the Lightwood Duo. We put out a Christmas album a while back, and we recorded that album in the summer before that Christmas. And it was very strange sitting in a recording studio playing these Christmas songs and sweating. And it was very hot. They had to turn off the air conditioning in the studio because the sound of the fans were coming over some of the microphones. So it was very, very hot in there. And it reminded me of the story behind this. In 1945, Mel Torme showed up for a writing session at the Toluca Lake house of his lyric partner, Bob Wells. And he let himself in because no one answered the door when he rang the bell. And he went in, and on the piano, there were some words on a notepad. And these words said, "Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos." Now, when Wells came back into the room, Torme asked him about it. And Wells said he was so hot that he just started writing something to cool himself off. And he said, "All I could think of was Christmas and cold weather." So I wrote those words down, and Torme said, "Hey, you might have something here." So he started writing the tune, and 45 minutes later, it was done. And they pitched it to Nat King Cole's manager. Nat loved it, and it took him a year to get around recording it, but he finally recorded it. It came out the late fall of 1946, and it was a hit. And so after it had been a hit for a while, on the original recording, Nat sang, "To see if reindeers really know how to fly." And after the song was a hit, Torme pointed out to him that that's wrong. You know, I mean, grammatically, that's wrong. It should be reindeer. And not, you know, thinking too much about it, I don't know how many people would even notice it. But Nat, being such a perfectionist, he got the same orchestration, went in and recorded it the same exact way, did the same exact recording so he could sing reindeer instead of reindeers. So this is my version of the Christmas song.
That's beautiful. That is beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Music composed in the summertime, I guess, right?
Right.
And you and Eric played it in the hot summertime.
Yeah. I've been asked to do a concert this coming summer and play Christmas music. They're going to have a Christmas in July, and so I'm going to be playing a lot of Christmas music on the concert in July.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun, yeah. Well, let's turn back to Tim Slover. What do you have for us next?
First of all, I just want to say there's nothing wrong with Christmas in July.
That's right. That's right.
I consider July an alternate Christmas month.
Yes.
Because there's so much music out there.
Yeah.
You can't really cram it all into December. So July is officially at our house also a Christmas month. So yeah. I'm going to go to that concert if I can.
And if somebody, not me, of course, if somebody watched the Hallmark Channel, it's so many Christmas movies, Christmas in July and then Christmas in December as well.
Good. I am not a diarist, but every once in a while I write down a reminiscence of my own life. And this is just a small one, a brief one of those. And I've called it Be Prepared. Those who know me, like you, Tom, and you, Mike, know I'm a little fond of the Christmas season. Christmas Day, yes, Christmas Eve, certainly, but really I like the whole darn shooting match. For example, I get a big kick out of going down to the Christmas tree lot run by the Boy Scouts, earning money for their troop to pick out the yearly Christmas tree. So as you know, the BSA motto is be prepared, and you better be when you match wits with these juvenile entrepreneurs earning their marketing merit badge while picking up a few extra bucks selling trees to the gullible. Is this tree fresh? I always ask. Fresh, says the Boy Scout. Sir, this tree was plucked from the bosom of Mother Nature not 30 minutes ago. That's a fib, I say. No, sir. Look, here's my honesty merit badge, he says, showing it to me on his sash of honor. That can't be a merit badge for honesty, I say, looking at it. Why not? He rejoins hotly. Because it's literally an image of pants on fire. I don't see a problem, he replies. Look, your sign says your trees are from Montana. That's right. So how could this tree have been cut down half an hour ago? Well, here's what they do up in Montana. They surgically slice the tree just where the phloem intercepts the xylem, and then immediately flash freeze it and transport it by courier jet helicopter directly to this lot in Provo. That's why the tree's a little stiff. See? It's just coming out of its beauty sleep. Needles are coming off in my hand. That's a good sign. It means the tree is still growing. New needles, which will emerge once you pay me, are pushing the old needles out. You'll see a lot of that. Well, okay. I guess that makes sense. I'm paying by check. Stop rolling your eyes. Who do I make it out to? What's the name of your Boy Scout troop? They named the troop after me. It was quite an honor, I can tell you, he says with a cherubic smile. So just make the check out in my name, and I'll pass it along to the proper scouting authority. Okay, I guess. How much? I ask. How much do you have? He answers. And thus the golden days of the festive season are past.
I think I've met that guy. We've all met that sort of salesman type, yeah. Starting early. Yeah. Be prepared, I guess the name of that.
Be prepared.
Be prepared. That's great. Well, thank you for that. Mike, what do we hear next?
There are some tunes that are not necessarily written for Christmas, but we always associate them with Christmas, and they've been passed down since they were originally written, and people like to perform them around Christmas time. This is one of those tunes. This is not necessarily originated as a Christmas tune, but this is from Willy Wonka, and this is called Pure Imagination. Thank you.
Beautiful. Pure imagination.
Yes.
Yeah. By the way, Mike, do you do most of these arrangements, or do you get arrangements made? Yeah. You do them yourself.
Do the arrangements, and then a lot of times, like with a tune like that, I'll play the melody, you know, an arrangement of the melody the first time, and then the second time on the repeat there, everything is improvised.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's so, like a turn it into a jazz piece.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by those. There's a real art to arrangement, right? And obviously an art to improvisation as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very fun to do. It's like standing at the top of the slope and skiing down it different every time you go down.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if you have a similar thought. Of course, you write a play, Tim. You know, the words are set, but do you do any adjustments once once it's workshopped, it's getting ready to be performed live?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so that's a good thing, because a theatrical text doesn't exist on a page. It exists up in a performance space, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I take every opportunity. Until it's published, you can do anything. And so I've learned, even after it's published, not from my own stuff, but from other people where I see two different published versions. So, yes, yeah.
And I guess that's the advantage of you versus a dead playwright.
Everyone changes their words.
They change them as well. So I guess maybe even more of an advantage. You can't. The playwright can't fight back.
You can only hope they're looking the other way.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Tim, what do we hear next from you?
These are two poems by a contemporary poet named Malcolm Gait. I want to spell his last name because I think everybody should look him up. It's G-U-I-T-E, Gait. At least you should look up an image of him, and I'll tell you why in just a second. But what an interesting guy he is. Malcolm Gait, he's an English poet. He's a singer in a rock band called Mystery Train. And he's also an ordained Anglican priest. He teaches at Girton College, Cambridge, also the Duke University Divinity School, and the Cambridge Theological Federation. He also has the advantage at this time of year of looking a lot like Santa Claus. He did a recent interview for a podcast called Mythmakers. That's actually not in Cambridge, but in Oxford at the Oxford Center for Fantasy. And he said that he'd been stopped on the high street and asked by children if he was Santa Claus. He assured them that he was, and that he frequently liked to come for a brief vacation in Oxford before his Christmas Eve flight. Well, last Christmas, so Christmas 2023, Gait was asked by King Charles III to read the following poem at Westminster Abbey Carol Service. I'm amazed by this poem because in just a few short lines, Gait manages to say a lot about tyrants, their victims, and manger scenes in churches. This poem is called Refugee. We think of him as safe beneath the steeple, or cozy in a crib beside the font. But he is with a million displaced people on the long road of weariness and want. For even as we sing our final carol, his family is up and on that road, fleeing the wrath of someone else's quarrel, glancing behind and shouldering their load, whilst Herod rages still from his dark tower. Christ clings to Mary, fingers tightly curled. The lambs are slaughtered by the men of power, and death squads spread their curse across the world. But every Herod dies and comes alone to stand before the Lamb upon the throne.
That's beautiful. Martin Gait, Refugee.
Malcolm Gait, Refugee. Refugee, that's obviously a poem about judgment. This next poem is Gait's one of mercy and hope, and he wrote this in 2022 when he was part of an international Christmas tour of music and the spoken word, just like what we're doing today. He finished writing the poem in New York, and so he read it first at Carnegie Hall. It contrasts the Garden of Eden and the garden tomb where the crucified Christ was interred. But crucially, he places us in both of those gardens. This is called A Tale of Two Gardens by Malcolm Gait. God gave us all a garden once and walked with us at eve that we might know him face to face with no need to believe. But we denied and hid from him
concealing our own shame. Yet he still came to look for us and call us each by name. He found us where we hid from him. He clothed us in his grace, but still we turned our backs on him and would not see his face. So now he comes to us again, not as a Lord most high, but weak and helpless as we are, that we might hear him cry. And he who clothed us in our need lies naked in the straw, that we might wrap him in our rags, whom once we fled in awe. The strongest comes in weakness now, a stranger to our door. The king forsakes his palaces and dwells amongst the poor. And where we hurt, he hurts with us. And when we weep, he cries. He knows the hearts of all our hurts, the inside of our sighs. He does not look down from above, but gazes up at us, that we might take him in our arms, who always cradles us. And if we welcome him again, with open hands and heart, he'll plant his garden deep in us, the end from which we start. And in that garden, there's a tomb whose stone is rolled away, where we and all we've ever loved were lowered in the clay. But lo, the tomb is empty now, and clothed in living light, his ransomed people walk with one who came on Christmas night. So, come, Lord Jesus, find in me the child you came to save. Stoop tenderly with wounded hands and lift me from my grave. Be with us all, Emmanuel, and keep us close and true. Be with us till that kingdom comes, where we will be with you.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Malcolm McKnight. That's beautiful poetry. And on that last poem, Mike Christiansen playing a little background. Thank you for that. Well, let's take a brief break. You're listening to the Access Utah Holiday Special, and we're hearing Mike Christiansen on guitar playing music for the holidays, playwright Tim Slover presenting humorous and poignant readings for the season. More following this. You're listening to the Access Utah Holiday Special. We do this once a year, very special time. Mike Christiansen comes in, plays the guitar for us, music for the holidays. Playwright Tim Slover, author of the Christmas Chronicles, among other works, presents humorous and poignant readings for the season. So we thank both of these gentlemen for being with us. And this is one of my favorite times of the year, this particular program. Hope it is yours as well. So let's jump right in. Here is part two of our special. Mike Christiansen, what do you play for us?
Well, the tune that everybody associates with guitar with Christmas. In 1818, there was this roving band of actors. The roving band of actors was performing in towns throughout Austria, throughout the Alps. On December the 23rd, they came to Obernoff, which is a village near Salzburg, where they were going to reenact the story of Christ's birth in the small church of St. Nicholas. Unfortunately, in this church, the organ wasn't working. Some people say that the mice had eaten through the billows, and some people say that it just rusted, but at any rate, it wouldn't work. So rather than do the program in the church, they did it at a residence. Well, one of the people that went to this performance was a guy named Joseph Moore, and he was an assistant pastor. And this performance put him in a very meditative mood. So he was walking home. Instead of going straight home, he kind of walked up on the hillside, and he looked down over this town. And he was so taken back by the picturesque look of this village that it reminded him of a poem that he had written earlier. And so he thought, you know, this poem would make a great lyrics for a song if I had some music to it. So the next day he went to Franz Gruber, who was an organist, and he also played guitar. Smart guy. So he also played guitar. And so he took this poem in and said, could you put some music to this? And we could perform this with the guitar, you playing the guitar, and we'll both sing it. So he said, well, I only have, Gruber said, I only have a few hours to do this, but I think I could do this. So he sat down and wrote Silent Night and put the music to that. Moore decided that the words were going to make such a great carol, and lucky for us, it worked out that way. And it was performed that Christmas with the guitar and two people singing it. Now, I have a copy of a copy of a copy of the original. And so I'm going to play the original Silent Night without the vocal part. I'll dub in a little bit of that so you can hear the melody in there. And then I'll soup it up just a little bit.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
How did you get a hold of that original version?
I think I was just looking through some old material that I had and came across it in a collection where some of the old traditional guitar pieces were found, and it was there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm struck. Tim and I gave a look to each other when you said this was composed in a couple of hours.
He didn't have long. Yeah.
So far, that's a theme this year. Geniuses who do things in no time at all.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Inspiration strikes, I guess, in some cases.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's turn back to Tim Slover. What do you have for us next?
Well, I sort of hate to break that mood, but this Tom could have been ripped right from the pages of Psychology Today. It wasn't, but it's that kind of thing. It's called Unleashing the Id at Christmas. And it starts with a little frontispiece by the psychologist, and then we hear from the patient. The patient, who claims to have issues with Christmas, and especially with one particular aspect of it, made clear in his statements which follow, was asked to express his feelings by addressing an imaginary respondent on the Noel topic of his choice. Below are his unedited remarks. This psychiatrist admits to being deeply disturbed by the naked brutality of the patient's statements. Cross-referenced with his Borealis profile results, they suggest a personality with serious jollity deficiencies, and moreover, one unable to mask with the usual Yuletide pleasantries his bitter Christmas disappointments of the past. I have prescribed 1/2 pint of eggnog taken hourly, along with a rigorous course of carol singing, but frankly, I believe the patient to be beyond reclamation at this point. I offer this transcript, nevertheless, as a source of study for those who may be treating patients in the earlier stages of humbug syndrome. May you be more successful than I. And here's the transcription of what he said. Okay, imaginary respondent, who is really my so-called best friend, Leon, I'm addressing you. You've been wondering, what do I get you for Christmas this year? Well, it's a little late to be thinking about that now, don't you think? You could have shown a little consideration and started concentrating back in August when I told you to, but you know,
forgive and forget, better late than never. There are a couple of weeks left for you to pull this off, so I'm still willing to work with you. And so, without further ado, how to get me a good Christmas present. First, though, I have to say, thank you for giving me Christmas presents. I know you don't have to, even though I always get you a really good one. I know you do it out of the goodness of your heart, and I appreciate it, I really do, but you know yourself, you've made mistakes in the past, serious mistakes. You've taken your eye off the ball and wound up getting hurt. It's not my fault, that look on my face I get when I unwrap your present and it sucks. No, that look is your fault. But on the theory that you don't want to repeat these appalling gaffes and that you really want to improve, I'm happy to help you correct them. But be warned, since kindness clearly hasn't worked for your own good, I'm going to have to take a firm line. All right, let's get down to business. Food is not a Christmas present. Try to remember that. Especially, and I know this is cliche, but it's true, especially not fruitcake. Really, honestly, why is there fruitcake? Haven't we all suffered enough through the year? But let's return to the point. Food just is not a Christmas present. Have I ever got you a box of Wheat Thins for Christmas? And it doesn't matter if it's really fancy food, like smoked oysters from Helsinki or hand-rubbed steaks from Omaha. Food is a present you take to a housewarming or a potluck affair, maybe. But it's definitely not a Christmas present. Why? Because people expect you to share it. They stand around waiting for you to open the box of chocolates or Williams-Sonoma peppermint bark or whatever, and you look like a jerk if you don't do it. But if you do open it, a Christmas morning horde lounging around in pajamas scarfs down your Christmas present. Sometimes you can get away with not opening the food item on Christmas morning if it's, say, brownie ingredients that can't be immediately consumed. But everyone remembers you got it, and they'll be around later for their cut. So, no food, okay? I don't want to look like a jerk. And speaking of brownie ingredients, don't give me anything I have to combine, cook, assemble, unravel, read directions for, or in any way turn into something it's not when it comes out of the box. See, I don't want to work. I want to enjoy. Some assembly required. That's not a cheery Christmas message. It's a sentence to hard labor. Look, I don't know how to put this delicately, and I know people feel differently about this issue, but you wanted to know how to get me a good Christmas present, right? So I'm telling you straight, no presents where I open it up and there's some fancy certificate that says some people somewhere have been given half a cow in my name. I know, I'm supposed to feel great and get a real warm glow out of knowing you cared enough about me to give my present to somebody else, but I don't. I feel cheated. I could have used that half a cow. This same principle applies to finding out I adopted an endangered Siberian tiger cub, or saved a square foot of Amazon rainforest, or kept 1/8 of the woodwind section of the orchestra alive for another year. See, all that stuff is great, and I support it in theory, but actually, I want a real present, please, for me. Oh, and definitely, and I mean definitely, don't pay good money to have some 18th magnitude star named after me. If I want my name on a light, I'll write it on one of our flashlights. Okay, and no clothes, really. Clothes are great, but come on, it's not like you're going to actually get me the $400 Nubuck leather blazer I keep showing you in the Territory Ahead catalog, is it? No, you're going to act on your brainstorm that I might want a gangsta rap of FUBU vinyl vest from the closeout rack at Ross. This just leads to heartache for us both because they don't take those back. It's a very difficult item to re-gift. I'm sorry. I'm being harsh. I apologize. I know you've done your best, and I know every gift is an expression of your love. Except executive gifts? What were you thinking? Don't pretend you don't know what executive gifts are. Those high-toned gadgets, cruel sales executives with a sick sense of humor put out in department stores on the last shopping day before Christmas, and then snigger while they watch the desperate snap them up to inflict on loved ones the next morning. It's the one pleasure these salespeople get to pull the Christmas Eve shift, and I don't begrudge it, but look, they're definitely sniggery at our expense. Executive gifts tend towards some combination of mahogany-stained wood and electroplated brass, and they're often some species of calendar, but with a clever twist. They alert you when there's a solar eclipse, or they change color when an orc comes into your office, or mostly they fall apart by New Year's Day. Avoid them. They signal the end of civilization. All right, let's review. You're not going to get me food or clothes or charitable contributions or gadgets, right?
And for heaven's sake, don't get me books. I've got too many. And anyway, I'm thinking of giving up reading. I mean, where's it got me? Or music. Don't forget that greatest hits of the Andy and Pampas fiasco. Or movies. There hasn't been any good movies since Weekend at Bernie's, so I'll just keep watching that. And no electronics or appliances. Please, have you seen our utilities bill? That just leaves cash. Oh, great. Were you thinking of giving me that? You got to be kidding. Nothing says I don't care enough to think for 1 second about you like a limp $20 bill. Unless it's a 10. So anyway, that's about it. I hope it's been helpful. I know you want to get me something really meaningful, a real expression of your regard for me. Don't worry. I know I'll love whatever you give me. Or you could just let me pick it out. After all, it's the thought that counts. And my thought was, why don't you lend me your Visa?
Love it. Love it. Unleashing the it at Christmas time. There you go. Yeah, just exchange visas. I guess that'd be the way to go. Thank you for that. Appreciate that. Yeah. Tim Slover. Mike Christiansen's with us. Yeah. What do you play next?
Another tune that not necessarily written for Christmas, but associated with Christmas, probably because of the references to sleigh bells and snowflakes and silver white winters and brown paper packages tied up with bows. So this is My Favorite Things.
My Favorite Things. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Love that arrangement. There's improvisations there. Yeah. It's Mike Christiansen on the guitar. You're listening to the Access Utah Holiday Special. Mike Christiansen on guitar and Tim Slover playwright, presenting humorous and poignant readings for the season. What's next, Tim?
Well, when I was a little boy, one of my earlier memories is my mother reading Winnie the Pooh to me and House at Pooh Corner. Those became cornerstones kind of literature for me. And when our boys were little, Mary and I read those to them. So A.A. Milne has been in our lives a long time, but I've discovered that he actually wrote a lot beyond those two wonderful books. Wrote for adults, wrote for Punch magazine, humor pieces. He wrote this poem called King John's Christmas. Most monarchs in England over all those centuries get repeat names, right? Henry the First, the Second, all the way up to Henry the Sixth. And Henry VIII, right? If you're a king that nobody wanted to be named John II, that means you probably didn't do very well. Victoria, of course, is the exception. So he takes King John, who really, you know, lived in the 13th century, but he sort of updates him as though he lived today. But he retains this whole idea of John not being a very good king. So this is King John's Christmas by the great A.A. Milne. King John was not a good man. He had his little ways, and sometimes no one spoke to him for days and days and days, and men who came across him when walking in the town gave him a supercilious stare or passed with noses in the air, and bad King John stood dumbly there, blushing beneath his crown. King John was not a good man, and no good friends had he. He stayed in every afternoon, but no one came to tea. And round about December, the cards upon his shelf, which wished him lots of Christmas cheer and fortune in the coming year, were never from his near and dear, but only from himself. King John was not a good man, yet had his hopes and fears. They'd given him no present now for years and years and years, but every year at Christmas, while minstrels stood about, collecting tribute from the young for all the songs they might have sung, he stole away upstairs and hung a hopeful stocking out. King John was not a good man. He lived his life aloof, alone. He thought a message out while climbing up the roof. He wrote it down and propped it against the chimney stack. To all and sundry, near and far, F. Christmas in particular, and signed it, not Johannes R., but very humbly, Jack. I want some crackers, and I want some candy. I think a box of chocolates would come in handy. I don't mind oranges. I do like nuts. And I should like a pocket knife that really cuts. And oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, bring me a big red India rubber ball. King John was not a good man. He wrote this message out and gat him to his room again, descending by the spout. And all that night he lay there, a prey to hopes and fears. I think that's him coming now. Anxiety bedewed his brow. He'll bring me one present anyhow, the first I had for years. Forget about the crackers and forget the candy. I'm sure a box of chocolates would never come in handy. I don't like oranges. I don't want nuts. And I have a pocket knife that almost cuts. But oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, bring me a big red India rubber ball. King John was not a good man. Next morning, when the sun rose up to tell a waiting world that Christmas had begun and people seized their stockings and opened them with glee, and crackers, toys, and games appeared, and lips with sticky sweets were smeared, King John said grimly, "As I feared, nothing again for me. I did want crackers, and I did want candy. I know a box of chocolates would come in handy. I do love oranges. I did want nuts. And oh, if Father Christmas had loved me at all, he would have brought a big red India rubber ball." King John stood by the window and frowned to see below the happy hands of boys and girls all playing in the snow. And a while he stood there watching and envying them all. When, through the window, big and red, there hurtled by his royal head and bounced and fell upon the bed
an India rubber ball. And oh, Father Christmas, my blessings on you fall for bringing him a big red India rubber ball.
A happy ending.
That's good, yeah. Even for King John.
That's wonderful. A.A. Milne, yeah, King John's Christmas. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate that. We'll turn back to Mike Christiansen. What do you play next?
This next tune is entitled Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and maybe not a lot of people know. This was written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. They wrote it for Judy Garland's 1944 movie Meet Me in St. Louis. And Martin wrote it based on a little madrigal-like tune that he liked, and he played it for 2 or 3 days, and then he threw it away and didn't think anything was going to come of it. Blaine heard the tune, too, and he told Martin that it was too good to throw away, wondered what he'd done with it. And he said, well, I threw it in the wastebasket. So they both dug through the wastebasket. They found it and finished it up again in short time. And they finished up in a very short time. Well, Judy Garland thought that it was too sad, and she asked for a revision of it. It was originally slower, I think. And the film's producer said, no, it's a sad scene, but we want sort of an upbeat song, but we want these lyrics in there, and it'll make it seem even sadder if she's smiling through her tears. And so this is Have Yourself a Merry Christmas.
Have yourself a Merry Little Christmas and a little Flintstones in there. Yeah.
Jazz musicians love to do what we call quoting. You swipe another tune and stick it in place because the chord changes are the same.
Oh, the chord changes are the same. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you. Well, let's hear. We're coming to the end of the hour. Let's hear your last piece here from Tim.
Thank you. I was thinking about wonderful people who adopt and the wonderful adopted children, and about how biology is one thing, but if you were to ask an adopted child, you know, who are your parents? I mean, they'd certainly name their biological parents if they knew them, but they would certainly also honor and love the parents that chose them and the parents that reared them.
And I was also thinking about an episode in the Bible. The Bible tells us that when Jesus was 12 years old, he and Mary and Joseph went up to Jerusalem from Nazareth, and they went to do a temple ritual. No one says what it is, a thank offering or something like that. And that made me think about Joseph, if he was Jesus's essentially adoptive father. And I thought about that moment when they find him in the temple. They've been looking all over Jerusalem, and there he is, and he's quite calm, the little 12-year-old boy speaking with the elders in the temple. And the moment when that happens, and when Jesus, as a little boy, talks about being about his father's business, didn't you know you'd find me here? I'm about my father's business. And what Joseph's reaction might have been. So this is a poem called The Carpenter, and it's written in Joseph's voice. I thought he was talking about me, so did my wife, in that place, God's place, we're told, cool and shadowed and with that peculiar smell you get there, burned resin and blood, and the boy, small among the grave, nodding scholars, his face eager and shining and forgetful, upturned, smiling to his mother, hers, grave and puckered with worry. She knew as I knew how little a thing, how easy to lose a son to the brutes and cutthroats of Jerusalem. Why did you slip away? We've been a whole day searching. The tremble in her voice took away his smile, and he was grave as the doctor's now. But I thought you would know. I would be here about my father's business. We thought he spoke of me, and I was not pleased at the bald, foolish lie, for my temple going is grudging, and I have no business there save what I must. And on the homeward journey, I had much to say to him, but as usual, meted out no punishment, for I was fond of the boy and could never bear to cuff him. And when in later years came the day, he went from our door and wandered out among the brutes and cutthroats. I waited till the sink of the sun, and in the following dark lay down in grief. My son, what business have you there? Here is stone and wood enough for us, here between the hill and the lake. She knew the answer, of course, my wife. They were always thick as two thieves, but I could make nothing of it. Today, he came back, my boy, spoke marvels to our congregation. I waited outside all eagerness, as he all those years before. But when he hurried from the door, it was in a roiling throng, and I could not clasp the prodigal to me. The crowd, prickly with anger, and the rabbi turned to me. You there, carpenter, this is your son, isn't it? Then my boy's eyes met mine. And all the years dropped away, and I was young again, footsore on my way to David's town, my new wife sitting our donkey, heavy with child, and a burning comet in the sky, turning over in my mind the searing saying of God and what he'd done. Again I smelt the blood and birth on the litter of the stable floor, heard the crowding sheep herders shouting of a new shepherd come, and the thrum of something joyful beyond reason beginning. But now my boy looked at me to see what I would say, and our angry rabbi too. I stood straight as a board I'd planed, didn't dare to say a word for fear of trembling and tears, but shook my head no and pointed up to where his father is, I think. But know this know, I shared in the raising of him. I did without. I showed him all the little that I knew. And then I let him go to tread his own path in a wild and wolfish world. And that's a father's place.
Beautiful. The Carpenter. Thank you. Mike Christiansen playing some music underneath there as well. Well, we've reached the end of our time. You've been listening to the Access Utah Holiday Special. Mike Christiansen on guitar, Tim Slover, a playwright, with readings for the season, And we thank Nick Porath for engineering for us. Mike, can you play us out with something?
I can. Yep. I'll play something, an original composition that I wrote one Christmas called Reflections of New Hampshire.